did the media miss as they covered the 2016 presidential campaign? Do you blame the media or credit the media for the election of Donald Trump? How about coverage so far of the transition of power in Washington, D.C.? What's your assessment? What do you want to see when it comes to coverage when President-elect Trump is President Trump? We have a lot to talk about this hour. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It is 8.5 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, November 21st. Join in with your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. And speaking of Twitter, later in the hour, I will ask our guest about President-elect Trump's latest newsmaking on Twitter and how Trump thinks Twitter is where it's at. And the new push to rid social media, or at least discourage you from sharing fake news. So all that this hour. Our guest is Jessica McBride, senior lecturer of journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Her research interests include investigative journalism, media and politics, as well as media criticism. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. And I understand. Tell us first about this new journalism project that you and your students are embarking on.
Right, and it's with our new broadcast instructor, Jessie Garcia, who a lot of people in the Milwaukee area would remember from Channel 4, where she was a sports anchorwoman for a long time. So it was in conjunction with her class, and we took 20 or so very diverse journalism students, and actually just got back at 1 in the morning.
Oh, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, we were there all weekend, and what we did is we went to three states. We went to western Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota, and we went to the counties that flipped among the most in the country percentage-wise from Obama in 2012 to Donald Trump. And it was fascinating. So Jessie was showing me this map she had found, and I looked at it and I said, this is actually a four-state phenomenon because it went down into northern Illinois, too. And these counties were along the Mississippi River Valley. So I felt like, you know, it's the river, in a sense, that's uniting this phenomena. And when you look at the map, it's striking. It's just stunning how these counties flipped and how they're clustered in this area of the Midwest. So we went out there and we actually talked to many people who flipped from President Obama to Donald Trump. And we had long-ranging conversations with them, everyone from someone who was shunned by the Amish community and used to be Amish in Harmony, Minnesota, to, you know, a retired gentleman who moved from Waterloo, Iowa, across the Mississippi to western Wisconsin, and he had a huge flashing Donald Trump sign, you know, outside, mm-hmm. and he had voted for Obama in 2012. And so, I mean, I can let you ask further questions.
Yeah, well, what was there, and it sounds like we have, we could do a whole hour on this as well, but there a theme from the voters you spoke with regarding why they switched votes?
Definitely, and let me just say this on the front end, because it was fascinating. My journalism students' impressions and perceptions and how those changed, I thought that was one of the most interesting things. A lot of my students are African-American from Milwaukee. And one in particular, on the way back, she said, you know, when I came here, I thought they're all racist, and I was worried, how am I going to be treated in these little rural towns? And she said, I thought there's no other reason you could have voted for Trump other than you're this full-blown racist. And she said, you know, some of them said things that I think people would construe as racist, and some of them probably are, but she said, for the most part, I didn't find that. She said, I was so interested. Her name's Nyesha Stone, a rising star in our department. She said, I found there are all these other reasons also, and she said, you know, I had never met a farmer in my life. And so there were these two-way conversations that happened. The students were treated incredibly well. They were welcomed into people's homes. They became practically like their kin, the way they were treated instantly. And what we found in town after town after town, it was economic stress. And to go back to the theme of your program today, I really felt after I got back home that there are two different conversations going on in America. There's the one on the TV screen of people shouting at each other in CNN or Fox News or whatever, pick your choice. And there are these conversations that were going on in rural America. And obviously that's only part of the story of the election. You know, the turnout mm-hmm. in the city is a huge story. We're doing that piece also. But focusing on these, you know, the white working class in rural America, the story of Pennsylvania, Michigan, you know, Wisconsin flipping red, you know, and it hadn't been, they hadn't been since the 1980s. These individuals were not motivated. They didn't bring up immigration right away. They didn't bring up, you know, Muslim bans right away. They didn't bring up these things. They didn't bring up the Billy Bush tapes. Like, I felt like the media were talking about the Billy Bush tapes and the Comey letter and groping allegations and all of this stuff. And these people are worried about economic stress. I mean, they have a, yeah. a desire for change, and they're motivated by a feeling that they're simply not able to get ahead whatsoever. And let me give you just one quick example, and then I'll let you ask more questions. But there was a woman we found who was working in a sort of a rundown cafe making pies, actually, from scratch. And she's 56 years old, and she said she makes $9 an hour. And she's supporting she supported, you know, four children on that for years. And we said, 30 years ago, you know, how much did you make an hour? $7.50 an hour. Now, the fascinating question then is, why did they pick Trump and not, you know, Clinton, who wants to keep Obamacare and maybe might be for more assistance from the government for individuals who are struggling? But it was this economic stress, this perception that I have, in fact, to use one of Trump's Twitter slogans, been forgotten. That people don't really understand my economic situation. And they felt, they weren't surprised Trump won either, so that's another disconnect. They, all, you know, people around them, they sort of knew that they were for Trump. So I guess in essence there were two conversations that were going on about this campaign.
It makes sense, and I'm glad you're doing this project, and I thought it was worth talking about right off the top because you were just doing it, but also because I think that's been noted as one of the failures of the media, which I know is a very broad term, but that we were not focusing as much as we should have been focusing on the economic issues or this so-called forgotten voter, that there was a lot of focus on the Twitter wars and the groping, as you mentioned.
I mean, they just weren't focused on the issues. And I was thinking about how the media covered this, and I think my biggest problem with the media, it's not like they're biased or all of this and that. I mean, I think it's a disconnect and a lack of geographic diversity, but I also think it's sort of a decline in reporting. You know, you look at these 24-hour news holes on cable, and you would think they would have, excuse me, more reporting and more resources to send to places like this. And instead, I think they've turned a lot more to opinion panels, which are cheaper to produce. And so you have, you know, David Axelrod and Gloria Borger on CNN and whoever that blonde woman is who's always supporting Trump, and you know, they sort of line up with their spins, and it's a war of strategy and punditry and spin, and it's not reporting. You know, it's not what these students did, which is literally knocking on people's farmhouse doors and going in their taverns and places that they live. And that's a decline of resources, I suppose, but it's a big problem, and it's happening on the local level too, obviously, with the decline in, you know, resources and local newspapers and all of that. So, you know, I wish there had been more actual reporting, I guess, and less easy focus on what you just aptly described as the Twitter wars or, you know, the latest sort of insults back and forth. And Trump, he's a genius at his use of that in terms of a marketing tool and baiting the media. He drove the news cycle a lot with Twitter is how I saw it. He would create some controversy, the media would all follow it like pilot fish, and then that controversy would dominate for the next few days. And he sort of seemed to adopt this attitude of it's better to be talked about endlessly even if it's negative talk, because it's basically, in a sense, free. You know, I don't have to then go do the paid media. I've got the free comp media. And yeah, it became that, didn't it? Like the whole.
But these people, and he admitted to a certain extent that that he thinks Twitter helped him in his campaign. He says it's where it's at, and he's continuing to do so with Right now, I was early this morning. Some of the cable news channels, the lead story was the Hamilton and situation,
right.
and Trump demanding an apology from the cast of Hamilton for giving a lecture to Mike Pence.
Well, so no one in these towns cares about Hamilton. They're not really. They could care less about this.
Mm-hmm.
It's another example. I mean, I thought it was interesting. I follow that. You know, the people in these towns, they're barely on the internet, to be honest. So their news comes word of mouth. It comes from local TV, maybe some radio. But, you know, they mentioned this. They're barely on the internet. They're not following Twitter. They're focused on sustenance, to be blunt, in their lives. And these skirmishes that are sort of endless in the media, you know, they're just not really what they care about.
Let me jump in, Jessica, because we do have news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio next, and then we have a lot of callers who want to weigh in with their assessment of how the media covered the 2016 presidential campaign. 1-800-642-1234. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about media coverage of the 2016 presidential campaign and how it is proceeding through the transition of power phase, and wondering what you think. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. What's your assessment of how news outlets covered the campaign? What did they miss? What did they do wrong, in your opinion? Did they do anything right, in your opinion? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Jessica McBride, Senior Lecturer of Journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And before we take some calls, I wanted to ask you, Jessica, about what Central Time is going to be talking about this afternoon on the Ideas Network, and what I planned on talking about a little bit during this hour is the ongoing battle between President-elect Trump and the media, and his, you know, dumping the press corps at one particular time, and talk
right.
about whether he's going to maybe not issue press credentials to some. Do you think that this is a concern?
Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, Thomas Jefferson famously said, if given a choice between government and newspapers, you know, he would choose newspapers. I think it's always fascinating that the people who dislike, you know, government the most also seem to distrust now the media the most, which, I mean, to me, the free flow of information is our best protection against quote-unquote big government and tyranny, and obviously we need a robust media with access to the president. I would note, though, you know, that President Obama was not an enormous fan of press freedom either, and the country does endure. I mean, I was looking up this article in the Columbia Journalism Review, where they actually, I mean, you know, people from the New York Times and so forth, here's one quote. They said, the administration's war on leaks and other efforts to control information are the most aggressive I've seen since the Nixon administration. And as journalists often note, the Obama administration has prosecuted more leakers under the 1917 Espionage Act than all former presidents combined. That was in 2015 Columbia Journalism Review. So the Obama administration was not, you know, as open to the media also as, you know, one would hope. I think it's always a concern, and it's always something that not just the media need to guard against, but the citizenry need to guard against. And it's deeply troubling, I think, how Trump has managed to sort of flip people against the media, you know, where they're perceived as part of this elite and establishment, you know, that simply can't be trusted anymore, where people are sort of losing their ability to tell the difference between opinion and reporting and spin and, you know, issue-based mm-hmm. journalism. And so when he dumps the media and he goes to this restaurant with his family, you know, I guess at first instinct you're like, get over it, who cares, why are you making this all about yourselves? But no, it's important because they need to have, I think, continual, you know, access to the president.
Let's take some calls, as we have many. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. The call that I was just going to take dropped, but that call was the common criticism that the media were biased in favor of Hillary Clinton. And this particular caller said he voted for Trump anyway, but it was, you know, he thought it was very apparent that the media was in Hillary's camp. What's your response to that?
I knew I was going to get asked that, so I was thinking about that, and I can't really deny. I mean, when I watched cable news, they seemed like not only were they against Trump, but that they were just certain he was done. Like they were telling us every week for weeks before the election that he had no chance, this and that. I think we need to differentiate among media, though. You know, what are we talking about? I think newspapers, you know, do a much better job. I still am partial to them, their contextualization of issues, their reliance on original reporting and going out and talking to people. And I'm a fan of newspapers, and I think they did a pretty good job of covering, you know, the presidential campaign, you know, not every single one of them, but overall. And local, you know, I mean, public radio, I think, did a very issues-oriented job. I think some of the local TV, I don't see this overt bias. So I wonder if they're talking about, you know, what they see on cable television news. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the cable television did have a lot of those opinion panels, as you mentioned. They tried to put, just anecdotally, a balanced number of Trump supporters and Hillary supporters on those panels. But there did seem to be a lot of coverage of the political models and the polls and that sort of thing. That those polls showed a close race, but Hillary ahead, and that was focused on so much that nothing else was really being mentioned.
And I think people, I would add, I think it's the Beltway elite media that they think is biased. You know, probably they would rope in some of the big East Coast newspapers into that, too. Going to the pollsters, here's a really interesting point. A lot of the professors who did academic models had a better job predicting this election. Not all of them, but there were sort of a handful of professors, and they tended to use economic models, and they're professors of macroeconomics and stuff. They got very little media attention, and their model looked at things like the election cycle, or, you know, the typical presidential elections, you know, sort of cycle of how people vote, and there were a number of them that predicted Trump. And that's interesting. So the pollsters, yeah, they completely got this wrong. Now, there was one Republican-leaning pollster. It was this boutique firm from Atlanta that nobody really had ever heard of or paid attention to. And they actually got it right in Pennsylvania and Michigan, and they called some of these states no one saw coming for Trump. And there was an interesting article I read about why that was. What they had found was that people were lying about, you know, voting for Trump. They were embarrassed to admit it, or they don't like pollsters, or they see them as part of the elite. And so they started asking people a question as to, who do you think your neighbors are going to vote for? And they found there was this, you know, percentage difference between what they would say and what they said their neighbors would do. And so they, you know, weighted their poll to take that into account and whatnot. And there was a second pollster that did better, where they had a measurement for enthusiasm. And we actually ran into that in, like, western Wisconsin, so forth, a lot, Minnesota, Iowa. We found a lot of people who didn't vote. And they tended to say, I hate them both. They were so terrible. And I hate government. I hate politicians. I trust none of them. It's hopeless. But if I had been forced to vote, I probably would have voted for Clinton. So there was this sort of enthusiasm gap of who ultimately turned out at the polls. I think in this area, voter ID might have played a role in that also, in suppressing turnout. We'll see, right? That's unproven, but it seems logical that it had an effect too. So my point is, some of the pollsters who did these extra measurements on enthusiasm and you know, taking into account people might lie about voting for Trump, actually did a better job of predicting it. We found one man who lied to a pollster. He told them he voted for Clinton, and he lives in this trailer house in Crawford County, Wisconsin, and he voted Trump.
Yeah, we had more than one caller say the same thing, that he was a Trump supporter, or they were Trump supporters, and they said they lied when they were polled. David in Racine is with us. Hi, David.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I drive an interstate truck, so I'm all across the fruited plain here, as a talk show host would say. And I I voted for Hillary Clinton. I didn't want to, but I did. But I'm not afraid of Trump. I'm not afraid of Hillary. This country is all about change. We've just had 8 years of Obama, and I don't think he's done that terrible of a job. And this race thing, I do believe that these high-paid reporters, talking heads in the morning, not yourself here, because I do believe public radio does get it right most of the time, but these talking heads, all they do is to incite and gin up people. They want to talk like the country's racist and this is racist, everything's racist. I can tell you in all honesty, I go all every state in this country, I don't believe racism exists on the level people are saying it does. And as far as Trump, people, you talk about the woman making pies. You know how many women I run into, 45, 65, working in truck stops for $9 an hour through divorce or bad choices, are really struggling. I've trained several women in their 50s now to drive trucks. They do a heck of a good job, and they're making three times the wages they were before, happy as clams.
Thank you, David. There's another story of women as truck drivers. But anyway, what about his thought, bringing back to the media part of it, that he thinks the media focused on race issues and ginned up our was it the media's fault that we were talking about race issues and immigration and refugees?
Well, I mean, you could argue it's Trump's fault because he was adopting very incendiary proposals about, you know, banning all Muslim immigration and doing mass deportations of illegal immigrants that no one thinks are feasible. And, you know, now he's sort of clarified or, you know, said, well, no, I mean, you know, illegal immigrants with criminal records. And I mean, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, he kind of started some of those conversations. I will say when we were speaking to the voters, they didn't bring those things up at all first as their driving concerns. And when you would talk to them, they would actually adopt, in most cases, not all, you know, fairly nuanced positions about it. You know, I had some people bring up the unrest in the cities, the protests or slash riots, depending on the city, I suppose, or how you want to call it. And, you know, they didn't like that, the attacks on police, the law and order issue. And then I had one student, African-American student, who said, what about, you know, the people the police have killed? And the man, who had flipped Obama to Trump, by the way, said, well, you know, actually, I think a lot of those are wrong, and the police should have been charged in those instances. And he cited the case of Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So, you know, it's actually fairly informed about even the cases he was referring to. I guess what I found is when we went out there, like, people had fairly nuanced, you know, positions and conversations, and we just didn't find this sort of overt racism where they started, at least started there. I mean, I suppose they could be hiding their position somewhat. I will say we found a little more with the Muslim issue, and I will say that we found a little more of that in Minnesota than Wisconsin and Iowa, which seemed more economically distressed to us. And obviously Minnesota is riven with these controversies and tensions with Somali, you know, refugees. And so that came up a little bit more, not as their sort of primary thing. It was always change, jobs, economics. When you ask individuals what they mean by change, though, that was fascinating because they kept saying change, change, change. That's why they voted Trump, economics, but change. And this man that you just had on as a caller used the term, too, and that was part of, obviously, Obama's slogan, right? But I think Make America Great Again kind of sees that change mantle, and they see Trump as this non-politician. So one guy, he was a hunter. We got him on the side of the road with his gun and all that, and he said, well, you know, I just want to see what Trump can do. I don't like the status quo. It's not working for me economically. It's not working for my neighbors. He's not a politician. He's a businessman. He can't possibly be worse. If he's terrible in 4 years, we'll throw him back out.
Let's take another call from Troy in Muskego. Hello, Troy. What do you think?
Yes, I think just the opposite. I think the media didn't do a good enough job of busting out Trump. I think that he was consistently lying and saying things and twisting and manipulating and playing himself as the victim. And I think the media had no choice. They had to question him on things. And when he was pressed, he would twist it around. And I think that people that say that, it's a way for them to clear their conscience, and it gives them this way of feeling like they're voting for the underdog. And in reality, it's funny that your guest was talking about what people voted for. In reality, Trump is actually anti-labor. So And if you think about it, that never even came up, that he's anti-union and anti-labor. It just goes to show you that the media was kind of like running constantly trying to chase him and hold him accountable for what came out of his mouth.
So was that happening, do you think, Jessica?
To some degree, I agree with your caller. I think he has a really good point. I mean, again, because it goes back to sort of the lack of focus on issues and the focus on Twitter wars. And I did find that fascinating. Here you've got this billionaire from Manhattan, you know, inherited money, and he's driving, you know, flying around in a gold-plated plane with his name on the side. And he's this, you know, the hero of the white working class. Like, it was sort of extraordinary. And so how did he, you know, accomplish that when, you know, as your caller noted, he mentioned the labor issue. I had mentioned Obamacare, public assistance, and just things where, you know, historically the Democrats were perceived as more of the voice of the working class. And I think what Trump did in part, he captured the voice, perhaps, and economic stress, I think, of these people who do sort of feel very disconnected, very disenfranchised. One other quick thing, though. Obamacare came up a lot, but maybe not in a positive way for the Democrats, because there was, on October 24th, I think this was sort of the true October surprise, actually, that the media, they talked about, but maybe not enough, because they were all talking about Billy Bush. The federal government announced massive increases in Obamacare premiums. And these hit some of these swing states the hardest. Minnesota had a 59% increase, and the Democratic governor there had even come out right before the election and said this is no longer affordable. We met a man who used to be Amish. He's partially shunned by the community. He runs a furniture store in Minnesota, and he told us his Obamacare premium cost is going up from $300 a month to $900. So, and this hit Pennsylvania also, and Wisconsin. We found the woman with the pies was talking about it also. So it was a little bit of an undercut, covered issue that perhaps cut somewhat into, you know, the Democrats' arguments that we're helping, you know, the working class to have those increases hit right before the election.
Saeed in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Saeed.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. Listen, I think the biggest of casualty of this election cycle is the mass media. They have lost so much credibility that in a recent poll, only 6% of the people said that they would trust what they hear. Let me give you examples. We now know that political reporters were submitting their work to the DNC for editorial input before they gave it to their own editors. We now know that CNN hired the deputy director of the DNC as a commentator, and then acted like, how in the world could this happen to us, that the questions before debates were leaked.
Yeah, and because we have news coming up, Saeed, so there, it sounds like, Saeed, you know, we don't trust the media, and we shouldn't. Look what, I think he's talking about collusion between reporters and the DNC.
Yeah, he's talking about WikiLeaks and, like, Donna Brazile, you know, giving questions to people, and that's a problem. I think there is a somewhat of a coziness, and I think it's, we're talking, though, about the Beltway media. We're talking about, and I, you know, I was an intern at CNN in college, and I just remember sort of I was the only person from the Midwest, and, you know, people were from elite schools in the East Coast, and you were hired from there, and there's not a lot of geographic diversity. There's not a lot of ethnic diversity in the sort of elite Beltway media. And, I mean, I think he does have a point. And when people heard them talking over and over again, Trump has no chance, Trump has no chance, and then he wins, and none of them saw it coming, it's a problem.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in because I have news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will continue talking with Jessica McBride, Senior Lecturer of Journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Her research interests include investigative journalism, media and politics, as well as media criticism. And we are talking with her about the media coverage of the 2016 presidential election, but also the ongoing coverage during the transition and the ongoing battles that the media is having with President-elect Donald Trump. We're welcoming your questions, your assessments, your thoughts, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. First the news, then we'll be back. Yeah. We are bashing the media this hour. No, we're actually talking about media coverage of the 2016 presidential campaign and the ongoing coverage of the transition. And we'll talk some about the future and welcome your thoughts, your questions, your assessments at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. As we just heard from a caller, one could argue that the biggest loser of the 2016 election cycle was the media. Between claims of bias and predictions that Clinton would win handily, there's a lot of reflection going on. We are taking a little deeper look at how the media covered the 2016 presidential election, and we will discuss more the relationship between President-elect Trump and the media and what that might look like going forward. We are talking with Jessica McBride, a senior lecturer of journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Her research interests include investigative journalism, media, and politics, as well as media criticism. She and her class and another class were traveling this weekend in western Wisconsin and Minnesota and Iowa and Illinois, rural areas along the Mississippi River, talking to Trump voters, voters who had voted in the last presidential election for President Obama, but this time around voted for Donald Trump. And they're trying to find out what was going on there. And it was primarily an economic reason why they did that. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our next caller is George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Yes, hi. Very interesting study. I'm wondering if you asked any of the folks that you talked to who voted for Trump whether they had voted for Sanders in the primaries in the spring before.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought that up. Now, we did see a difference among the states. For whatever reason, the people we asked that question in Wisconsin did not and said things like, Sanders is a socialist, he's a communist, and things like that. Didn't like him. It tended to be older people who said that. But we did find people who liked Sanders, especially in Iowa, some of it in Minnesota. And let me give you one example. There was a female bartender, and you know, she owns the tavern, entrepreneur, used to be a welder, used to be a farmer in her 50s in this town in Howard County, Iowa, which the county flipped the most in the country from Obama to Trump, 42% shift, which is sort of astonishing. And she's in this town where there's two bars and pretty much nothing else other than grain silos, and she's lived there all her life and said how it used to be there was so much more going on. There were, you know, so many more businesses, a movie theater, and all of this. And she said she voted Democrat for 40 years, and she supported Bernie Sanders. And she would have voted for Bernie if he had run against Trump. But she switched to Trump first time in decades, and it was driven by change, economic stress, the belief that he's not a politician, he's a businessman. Let's see how he tackles this issue. She said there used to be a John Deere plant anymore area in town. There's not anymore. Like this came up a lot. You know, companies that were very important to these areas leaving those areas. And I wanted to make sure I get this point out because it was fascinating. Several of these people said, we voted for Trump, but we love Michelle Obama. Like, they love Michelle Obama. And we're like, really? Like, that's fascinating. And they said, we would vote for Michelle. And they loved Barack Obama at the time, but they felt he didn't deliver on what they hoped, which they can't really define, I guess, that he would do for their lives.
And in a way, a lot of people viewed Hillary Clinton then as an extension of Obama, and they didn't see that change there.
Right, in the past. You know, she's sort of defined by the past and her husband, and although they liked Bill Clinton, so maybe she missed an opportunity to bring up her husband's economy more, quite honestly. They liked Bill, and they liked Obama at first, and they're disappointed they like Michelle. They're really swing voters, classic. They split their ticket a lot.
Did you talk to them at all, Jessica, about did they just dismiss some of his Trump's controversial?
Completely.
Yeah, completely.
Completely dismissed it. You know, a lot of the people, and I'm just repeating them now, don't blame me, and they said, It's just locker room talk. They repeated that line. They said, I talk like that. People in taverns talk like that. We don't care about that at all. It's ridiculous. Some of them thought it was unfair. It came up too last minute. It's just people saying he did it without proof. They felt it seemed too coordinated, and they just literally just disregarded it. I will say, though, that we didn't find a lot of people who think Trump is perfect or great. They really actually hated both candidates, to be honest. Mm. They decided in the end we're going to pick him because of these reasons I've been citing.
Yeah. So Michelle on Facebook says, the media favored Trump, giving him lots of free publicity. The media is controlled by corporations primarily. Talk some about that argument that there has been that argument that the media just kept on reporting everything that that Trump said and gave him a ton of free publicity without a real critical eye. Do you think that is what happened?
I think there's truth to that. I think he received negative publicity, but they were sort of always talking about him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was able to do something pretty extraordinary, which is to run outside of the network of donors. And, you know, he had the party establishment at the end, but, you know, to sort of go against the party establishment in the primary, especially. And he was able to have this massive quantities of what they call earned media or free media, you know, which is they're endlessly talking about him. And I do think that was a problem because, as I mentioned, his use of Twitter was sort of twofold. He spoke outside of the media filter to millions of people, you know, and he was able to counteract what he saw as unfair narratives, and which in some cases I think were. But then secondly, again, he drove the news cycle. That's what he was doing, like sort of over and over again. He drove some of the conversations. And they might have been trashing him, but they're talking about him all the time. And, you know, that's pretty powerful. And his messages were very simple and sort of endlessly repeated. And even if they're criticizing him for those messages, some of those came through. I will also say that a lot of people were voting against Hillary, too. Like, we were sort of stunned by the degree of dislike for Hillary as a candidate. Bernie, you know, like I said, some of them liked Bernie and would have voted for him. But I think Biden, frankly, could have won. Mm-hmm. Biden wouldn't have lost Michigan and Pennsylvania and, you know, coal country of Pennsylvania, of course, and they call it Biden country. I don't think he would have lost western Wisconsin. It's just a hypothesis I have, but I think Joe Biden, probably could have defeated Trump, because I don't think these voters became Republicans overnight. They didn't. They don't define themselves as Republicans. They define themselves as sort of candidate-specific and issue-specific people. And I think they're, frankly, up for grabs for both parties.
Let me just ask, though, do you think that the Republican talking points or the Republican media messages got to a lot of voters that Hillary Clinton was this extremely flawed, untruthful candidate, and emails, and that helped convince people that Hillary Clinton was a bad
people
candidate.
People brought that up, and I think, however, they might argue, well, it's not the media telling us that, it's the fact she did it. Like, mm-hmm. I don't like the sort of looseness around the classified materials and all of that. But I thought it was interesting they would go, Hillary's a liar. And I said to one of them, you know, well, do you think Donald Trump has lied? You know, and they'll give him every single pass. And I think he endlessly repeated this line, she's a crooked, she's a criminal, and just tagged her with that, with his use of Twitter and the media constantly repeating these claims. It did sink in, because he's been caught flipping all these positions and lying about things, and she's been caught in some lies, and they were giving, like, you know, him all of these passes, but defining her that way.
We're running close to the top of the hour. Gary on Facebook says, Donald Trump has already led the way in exposing the media as corrupt, dishonest, and wrong. It will be very instructive and entertaining to watch him refuse to cower to their bullying and stand up against their liberal agenda. The more the media attacks him, the stronger he will get, and this will serve as an inspiration for us all. Reaction to that, and whether what you see going forward, the relationship between President-elect Trump and the media.
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of battles, and, you know, he uses he baits the media and all of this. I think the man speaks to a point, though, of these two conversations I started with. There's a disconnect between the media and parts of the country. I'm speaking, again, specifically of the Beltway media, the big sort of media. I think they need more geographic diversity. They need more reporting, and they need more ethnic diversity, and they need to get out of New York and their studios and, you know, do what 20 journalism students just did and actually go have conversations with people. And not just people, you know, the white working class. What about what happened in the cities? That's the second part of this story. Hillary Clinton did not turn out the Obama coalition in the cities. And so, you know, is that in Wisconsin because of voter ID, which was the first election we had? I mean, the media are sort of telling me that happened, but I'm not seeing a lot of them telling me why that happened. And we have the UW again. They're doing this huge study to send all these cards to all of these voters in the cities to see if voter ID kept them home. And how come the media aren't doing that type of investigative journalism? Thank God the UW is. But, I mean, I'd like to just see them get out of their studios and stop relying on these shouting strategists, you know, back and forth, and get out into communities, into cities, and into these counties, all over our country, and then you'll see less of this disconnect. I mean, these people feel that right now, and this is the worst part. After the election, they feel like they're all being called racist and sexist. So now they turn on, you know, the media, and some people in the Democratic Party and in the big media, they're saying that all these Trump voters were just sexist racists. And so you've got this woman in Lime Springs, Iowa, who's telling us, I'm not a racist, I voted for Obama. I mean, you know, and is that a way for the Democratic Party to win these people back? Is it a way for the media to sort of win the trust of these people back, to just sort of make assumptions about them and call them names?
What are you going to do with your journalism students project? Are we going to see or hear this anywhere?
Yes, please. So we have a news site. It's called Media Milwaukee, and we're on Facebook, but we also have a news site. So you can go to MediaMilwaukee.com. And don't look for it for a couple weeks, because we've got all this multimedia video, audio, print, all the written word, and we have 20 students, and we're going to spend time to make this really, really strong. We've got the goods, though. Their notebooks are filled with incredible stories.
Yeah, and so we'll follow up, too. Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jessica McBride, Senior Lecturer of Journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Thank you to producers Chris Molina and Nyasia Ellison. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There is much more to come. It's our State Capitol Report coming up next. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.